The Incomparable, number 526, August 2020.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell, and this episode is a very special one. It's a meeting of our comic book club, but what we're going to do is something a little bit different, something we've done with the book club a few times. I feel like comic books sometimes and graphic novels are super intimidating because so many things are like ongoing series and there's continuity and you don't know where to jump in. And also that I will say graphic novels sometimes get short shrift because people are very focused on like big names and ongoing stories when they should be finding really nice graphic novels that stand alone. And the goal of this episode is to assemble a reading list of possible things for you to read, to pick up a comic book, pick up a graphic novel. It's going to be something that you don't have to have done any previous homework to read. It's going to be available in a collection or a trade or a graphic novel, so you're not going to have to go buy comic book issues if you even have a comic book store or anything like that. We're going to try to make it super easy. Good stuff for you to read on the comic book side, on the graphic novel side. Joining me to assemble our reading list today are the following wonderful people, in the order in which they will pick. Not quite a draft, but similar. It's a cousin to the draft. David J. Lohr is here. Hello.
Hello. All I can say is crack-a-thoom.
Okay, good. Excellent. Lisa Schmeiser right. Also joins us.
Excelsior? Hi.
Okay, that works too. John McCoy is out there. Hi, John.
Hi. I guess Biff and or Pow.
Okay, good. Nathan Alderman.
I'm the best there is at what I do, and what I do is make self-aggrandizing statements.
All right. And Chip Sutter.
Some days you're Spider-Man with flaming bagpipes. Other days you're just Batman with a uke.
Mm. Oh my gosh, I reference watched that on loop. It was so great.
Reference acknowledged.
I'm always flaming bagpipes.
So here we are. We're just going to make, you know, there's six of us. So we're going to come out with a multiple of six. I'm thinking maybe 18, but we'll see how fast we go through them. But we're going to make some recommendations so that you have a nice list. And we're going to start with David J. Lohr. David, what is your first recommendation and why?
Wow. With first place comes great responsibility.
It doesn't. It's not a draft. It's just fine. It's in the end, it'll be basically an alphabetized list. It's fine.
Sure. You say that now. I got to say, one of my favorite comic books in the last, 20 years is The Amazing Adventures of the Escapist, edited and overseen by Michael Chabon, spun off from The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. But you don't need to have read the book to enjoy the series of comic books.
Although, to be clear, it is a great work of literature, and it won a Pulitzer Prize, and you ought to read it, but you don't have
absolutely.
To.
Absolutely. It is on my 10 books of you must read this book, mm-hmm. right? And I don't know if I even have 10 books on that, but it's like in the top three. And yeah, no, it's a great novel. I've talked about it before on the show. Mm. And part of it is about the creation of and writing of this comic book series about the escapist, who is a magician who has other secret powers and abilities. And, you know, he solves crime and it's great. And I think it was Dark Horse Comics had the idea of, hey, why don't we actually do that? And they put it out in these quarterly editions. So they're all really nice graphic novel sized collections. It was never a comic book. It covers various eras of the escapist through history, quote unquote, as if it were a real thing from the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And it is just delightful. If you have any interest in comic book history, if you have any interest in pulp heroes, it is a beautifully written and drawn pastiche. They brought in some of the great comic book artists and writers to do stories for it. Even Will Eisner's last actual comic book story. It's an amazing collection of books, and I wish they had been able to do more.
Yeah, I've read those. They're very good. They're very nice.
Yeah.
The Amazing Adventures.
I'm staring at them 6 feet away from me right now.
Of the Escapist. Well, good. Keep your social distance from your...
It's
clear. All right. That one's on the board. Add to the list. Not competitive at all. Lisa Schmeiser, what's your addition to our list? It's collaborative. This is more of a collaborative game.
It is. So I took a look at my recommendations and kind of grouped them by theme. And my first entry into tonight's reading list is actually the theme of Maiden Mother Crone, Because these books are sort of related in that arc. And the first one I wanted to talk about was Lucy Nisley's work, Something New. Lucy Nisley is an autobiographical comic artist. And she's famous for a book called French Milk, which is her illustrated travel diary of a trip she took to France with her mother when she was a senior in college. And she's since gone on to do other graphic novels that chronicle other chapters in her life. And I think Something New is her best work because, and it's actually, I think, the best entry point into her work because it's her account of reconciling with an on-again, off-again relationship of several years when they finally come around and want the same thing and want to build a life with each other. And then it's her account of getting engaged and getting married. And much of it is how she parses her responses to the bridal industrial complex and has to sort through her very complicated feelings about what it means to have this shifting public role. She goes from being, a single comic artist to an engaged partner over the course of like 24 hours. And after that, she's like, everybody's looking at me differently. Everyone's talking to me differently. So she parses her responses to the bridal industrial complex. And her wedding, she's an artist. Her community are all artists, and she has this big, beautiful DIY wedding, and she also details the types of relationships she has with other people, the really gentle and quotidian conflicts that pop up between her and her friends and her loved ones as they're trying to pull this all together, and then the wedding itself, and the way she just floats into married, the way she floats into married life afterwards, and what it felt like to live and chronicle every step of that transition. So if I knew anybody who was getting engaged, I would definitely give this as a gift. And it's just a fun read. It's autobiographical comics done right. The second one I wanted to recommend in this arc is called The Shiniest Jewel by Marion Henley. Marion Henley was a stalwart in like indie weekly publications all through the 80s and 90s. And she's got this really beautiful, rollerball type style. It's kind of like if Christian Dior's New Look was run through a 1980s MTV aesthetic. It's very kinesthetic. It's very lively, very stylish. And this is actually the memoir of her turning 50 and deciding to grow her family through adoption and her efforts to try to adopt a child from Russia while her father is also slipping away with cancer. And it's beautifully observed, beautifully detailed, a lot of fun. We don't talk about Henley that much, either as a comic strip artist or a cartoonist, and I really think she's underrated. I would urge people to go buy it. You can get the book for $1.85 on Amazon. And finally, for the crown, and at the end of the arc, I really loved Roz Chast's Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, which is her documenting her parents' decrepitude and death. She was an only child. She ended up having to caregive for both of them and help two very confrontational and neurotic people negotiate the last decade or so of their life and their eventual entry into assisted living and then their decline and their death. And it's just beautifully observed and funny and compassionate and unsparing all at the same time. And it's just another one where I read it and I sat there for a few minutes with it. And then I like flipped it over and started reading it again to see what I'd missed the first time. So all three of those are just great books that reflect life passages that people have. And that's part of comics that as I get older, I like seeing those experiences reflected more in a graphic novel format.
Well, Lisa, I don't think anybody has played the game better at picking three things in one pick. In the 10 years of this podcast, I think I'm very impressed. But well, if this was a draft,
challenge accepted.
If this was a draft, I wouldn't allow it. But since it's a collaboration, yeah, I'm going to let it slide. Thank you. Those all sound really great. And I had never heard of any of them. So see, it's already working its magic.
Yay!
John McCoy, you are up next. You don't have to pick three things.
I will not, but I will pick a monumentally long graphic novel, which is Eddie Campbell's Alec, The Years Have Pants, which is a compilation of all of his autobiographical comics starting around 1979 and ending around 2008. So it tells the story of his life. Now, it's named Alec because his alter ego in the comics is Alec McGarrity. And like Eddie Campbell, he starts out a young Glaswellian living in London during Thatcher's Britain. overeducated for the job he has at a sheet metal factory, becoming close friends with the blue collar workers there, and spending his nights basically inhabiting a single pub and getting into fights, getting into complicated romantic situations. Over the years, he slowly extricates himself out of that situation, meets his first wife, who is Australian, moves to Australia in 1986, and has a bunch of kids. Now, people who know Eddie Campbell at all probably know him as the illustrator of From Hell, or they might know him as he did a Batman, I think, it's set in Victorian England, too. Eddie Campbell is one of the new wave of British cartoonists who came out in the early 80s in Thatcher's Britain, and who came in sort of the post-punk era. This is actually the same era that brought us Jamie Hewlett, who would go on to do Tank Girl and eventually The Gorillas. And Campbell is a very sly, very closely observant cartoonist. He has this extremely scratchy impressionistic style, and it keeps changing throughout the course of this book, because with each new section, each part of his life, he takes on a different approach. He's very arch in his humor, the way that only I think the Scottish can be. And he has had such an amazing life that starts from this kind of an underachieving point in the 80s to eventually becoming fairly well to do because of the large check that was cut for the screen adaptation of From Hell, whether or not that was a good adaptation or not. But it's an amazing work of fiction. It runs, I think, something like 450 pages.
According to Amazon, it's 640 pages.
640 pages.
But you can get it on Kindle or Comixology for $11. So
exactly, you can. And if you read, if you spend time with this, you will feel like you have come to know him over the course of 30 years, and it's time well spent.
Wow!
$11 is nothing,
right?
For that.
That's how about amazing. That? I mean, obviously, seriously, the print ones are more expensive, but the digital one, yeah, $11. That's what? Can you put a price on one man's life? Apparently, you can, and it's $11. Thank you, John. That's great. I did not know that Eddie Campbell did that. That's great. And congratulations to all artists who get their, you know, work turned into a movie. Mm-hmm. Cash those checks. Cash them. Nathan, what are you adding to our list?
My favorite new comic in recent years is one that you cannot buy for any amount of money because it's given away free on the internet. But it's not your typical, like, gag-a-day web cartoon. It's a full-fledged, amazing, action-packed, thrilling superhero saga. I'm going to sum it up real quick, and this will tell you right away if this is your jam or not. Imagine a superhero who looked like Prince, fought like Batman, and talked like Bertie Wooster. If you are going, yes, please, then you want to read Lavender Jack by Dan Scady with colors by Jen Manley Lee. You can find it on webtoons.com. Just go there and search for Lavender Jack. And the premise is in an alternate reality where there is a country in Europe that has been carved out of the existing territories by exiles and outcasts from all different lands, there is a beautiful city called Gallery that is rotten to its core. It is as corrupt as all get out, although there is a veneer of respectability above it, on top of it. And in the middle of this corrupt city emerges a mysterious vigilante in a devil mask, the ever-charming, ever-dapper and debonair Lavender Jack. And he is on a mission to uncover the hidden corruption in the city and expose it. And the problem is that he runs into a pair of adversaries along the way who can best be described as Murder Tarzan and What If Jane But a Psychopathic Mastermind. And the beauty of this series is that it meshes the familiar and the new in a really wonderful way. it has all of the tropes that you want from this kind of pulp story. The dashing vigilante with a double life, the faithful aide-de-camp, the aging master detective, the rough-and-tumble honest cop who's on the come-up. But it seems to fill out all these characters with like a randomized roll of the dice as in terms of their ethnicity, their sexuality, their gender. So the master detective is a black woman who is maybe in her 60s or 70s, is built like a mountain, is bald, and is fiercely devoted to three things: the truth, her ailing wife, and their adorable French bulldog. It is just an absolute delight in terms of, and it's off the charts great in terms of the representation that it has. There are gay characters, trans characters, there are all different kinds of characters, every color of the rainbow, every spectrum of human sexuality, but it doesn't matter because that's not who they are. It's just who they are. And it's always in service of a genuinely thrilling, exciting, thought-provoking, and action-packed series. They finished up the first volume last year. They are now in the middle of their second volume, where after dealing with Murderer Tarzan and Psychopath Jane, Lavender Jack has to do battle with a mysterious figure called the Black Note, who has some definite ideas about society that do not mesh with Lavender Jack's. But the beauty of the series is that the characters are all so interesting and well fleshed out and thoughtful and complex that even someone like the Black Note, you're allowed to feel some measure of sympathy for. Even Murder Tarzan, you end up feeling a little bit sorry for. So yeah, it is just an absolute breathtaking read. It comes out once a week, and every installment feels like you've just read a whole satisfying issue of a comic book. It gets to the point where, especially in the last few weeks, it has been chock full of fist in the air, awesome hell yeah moments. And I cannot recommend this series highly enough. That's Lavender Jack by Dan Scady and colors by Jen Manley Lee.
Yeah, that was on my list. Dan lives just a short ways up the road from here. And I discovered it by accident last year because for Inktober, his daily challenge was redrawing Will Eisner's The Spirit, but as John Cena in all kinds of John Cena poses. And they go look them up. It's like The Spirit as John Cena. It's fantastic.
Yes, and he's very Eisnerian in his style because he actually worked with Matt Wagner on a revival of The Spirit before he started this.
Right. That's part of what gave him the idea to do that. And yeah, this is just delightful, delightful storytelling.
All right, Lavender Jack added to the list. They even beat the price on poor Eddie Campbell's life by $11.
Take that, Eddie.
Oh, man. A lot of bargains. We're finding bargains here. This list is a bargain. Chip, Sudearth, you can pick as many as you like, and it can be any price you want, but one is probably the best number to pick.
How about two? Because Lisa is a bad example.
Okay, go ahead.
But I've got a
fantastic example.
I'll allow it.
But I swear to you, I have a theme here, because two of the items on my list actually work well together when you're thinking about the gig economy and crowdfunding. One of them is a comic from Image called Crowded. Started coming out in 2018, and it's about a really, really horrible young woman named Charlie Ellison, who is who's just into all kinds of stuff. She's very selfish, and she did something or other to piss off the entire world, because you can crowdfund assassinations with a platform called Reaper, R-E-A-P-R, and somebody's put millions of dollars down on wanting Charlie Ellison dead. And so she hires a woman named Vita Slatter, who was the lowest rated bodyguard on the Defend app. And there are 12 issues of just bat crap crazy hijinks as this bodyguard and her charge try to figure out who is after Charlie and why, what Charlie did. Charlie is a very, very good liar, so it's very difficult for Vita to figure out why her client is such a target. They hate each other. They fall in love with each other, arguably. It's satirical. It's kind of wild, very, very funny. And I highly recommend it. It's written by, Christopher Sabella, and it's drawn by Rose Stein and Ted Brandt. I found out about this comic because, one of the rough things about the comics industry right now is piracy. And Ted Brandt made a very public plea because his comic was so well reviewed and was just burning up the pirate sites. And the volume 3 of this comic is going to be released straight to trade paperback. But issues 1 through 12, the two volumes are available in paperback or on Comixology, and I highly recommend it. So that's the gig economy. The crowdfunding and the gig economy. The other one I want to bring up is Image Comics Afterlift. And what if you're a driver for hire and your passenger wants to take a soul to hell?
I don't know the answer. Was I supposed to answer? I don't know.
No. That's what you have to read the book to find out.
Seems like you're in a real lose-lose relationship with the rating on that app for that gig.
Yeah, well, the driver's got to figure out what to do and whether and how to rescue her charge from the crazy demonic car chases into hell, the bounty hunters from the abyss. Angels are found. Tough choices about the driver's childhood are revealed. It's really, really quite affecting. It's written by Chip Zdarsky, who's probably best known as the artist behind the comic Sex Criminals, drawn by Jason Liu. I love it to bits. It's very moving in the end. Not as funny as Crowded, but these are both sort of taking a look at the gig and crowdfunding economies, probably worth reading now while the shine is coming off of both of those before they feel too dated. But right now, I think they're perfect for the times.
All right. Sounds very topical. You went topical and you picked two things. Thanks, Chip. We're not going to have an even number of six, a multiple of six, are we? That was a lie I told at the beginning. You know, no
Lisa
podcast.
Made me do it.
No podcast survives contact with the enemy. I mean, the panelists.
At base, I blame Monty. Monty
no,
bends
I
the rules.
I really like no podcast survives contact with the panelists.
Yeah.
put that on t-shirt.
So
that's the title.
I feel bad about this, but I'm going to pick some things that are on one level seem conventional, but are not conventional. So I am a lifelong kind of Marvel Comics kid, you know, from when I was very little. I am going to recommend a Marvel comic that is about even an established Marvel character, but it is so weird and so delightfully not what you'd expect that I think it's worth a look, whether you've read Marvel Comics or not. It's Tom King and Gabriel Hernandez-Walta's The Vision.
Oh,
that was
yes.
on my list.
Lisa gasps.
Yes.
It is a family drama where the family are androids and some very strange things happen. Very strange things happen. There's death and destruction and mystery and cover-ups all in this suburban environment. It's basically your, you know, Desperate Housewives kind of thing, except if they were all androids. That's essentially what it is. It's got some Marvel Comics stuff in it, but really it is unlike any Marvel comic kind of thing you'll read. It's a 12-issue miniseries, so you can just get the whole story and read it. I doesn't matter what continuity it's in, doesn't matter any of that stuff. I'm not going to pick a Marvel comic that requires 500 issues of knowledge in order to get into it. It's really smart. It's very strange. You will think you know where it's going at several points, and I assure you, you were wrong. Honestly, being taken on a ride like that, one of the things I admire about it is that in a system where you're dealing with a company that's owned by Disney and generates movies, and the comic books are on the side, and there's sort of there is an intellectual property farm, to see something like this get executed, like some other stuff like Hawkeye, you know, it's always remarkable when you see something that's really a work of art come out of Marvel, because, you know, a lot of the stuff is really about commerce more than it is about art, but the vision is worth reading. So check it out. That's my item. I know I just picked a Marvel comic, but it's great.
Oh,
and Lisa endorsed it. So there.
It's so good.
It's way, way better than it ought to be. Yeah.
Oh. Sad and beautiful with this haunting drumbeat of impending doom. Yeah. I third that recommendation hardcore.
I win.
Always feel like if there's going to be a syllabus on comics that accurately reflect the American dream, like comics that say this is what the American dream is, and then either deconstruct it or analyze it, like the vision is right up there. Like the Northern Virginia suburb part just detailed kills me. It's so perfect. Yep. Oh, God, I love it.
All right, let's go around another time. David, what do you have next?
All right. Well, I'm going to pick four things, but it's really just one series.
I've created a monster.
I had this on my list already. Mm-hmm. Darwin Cook did four adaptations of Richard Stark's Parker novels. There are like 20 something novels in the series. He did four of the best novels as just standalone graphic novels. Parker is a ruthless, dark, just misanthropic criminal, right? He is there to pull the score, pull the hit. If people die, so much for them. And he's sort of the dark, serious flip side of Donald Westlake's John Dortmunder. Donald Westlake and Richard Stark are the same person, and the Dortmunder series started when he started writing a Parker novel that turned comic, and he's like, Parker isn't a funny character. We can't do funny with Parker. He has been adapted into several films like Point Break, Payback. The first time he got to use the first time anybody used the Parker name was for the really not very good Jason Statham movie, Parker. No, if you want a good adaptation of those books, go to Darwin Cook. They're amazing. He adapted The Hunter, The Outfit, The Score, and maybe my favorite one, Slayground, which is sort of at an abandoned theme park. And it's just, they're just crackerjack.
All right, Darwin Cook's Parker. Got it down. Lisa, how many are you going to pick this time?
79.
No, I've decided I'm just sticking with one this time.
All right, I guess.
I felt very strongly about the whole maiden mother crone thing. But if you insist.
No, I don't. I don't insist.
Okay, I'll leave the tights and flights category for last then. No, what I was going to recommend was Monstrous by Marjorie Liu and Sana Takeda. And it's so visually trippy, and it's a difficult comic to explain because basically it's about a very young woman who's a war refugee who is the host for a being from another dimension who may or may not be senile or brainwashed, but is definitely really into eating people. And she has to traverse this landscape where one political faction is headed by a group of witch nuns who like eating body parts off of magical animal-human hybrids. The other kingdom in play is the kingdom comprised of magical animal-human hybrids who may or may not have preceded the evolution of humans on this earth. There is an order of mystical cat wizards that are involved in a weird political fashion. There's also a humans first empire that's based in rationality and scientists and may or may not have nuclear bombs. There's an extraterrestrial invasion involved. It sounds bananas. It really does. And, you know, you read it and it's one of these where you kind of have to keep track of who's allied with who. And it takes four or five issues to really get a bead on who all the players are. It's as if someone looked at Game of Thrones, either the books or the TV show, and said, yes, but what if set in a fictitious Asian country, it's all matriarchies, it's in comic form, and it's in comic form, and there's also a little kid who is part fox and may have the ability to talk to extraterrestrials. And it's bananas. It's beautifully drawn. And there's lots of bad guys, like really bad, bad guys, but it has a lot of really interesting and incisive things to say about politics we're all in court playing politics level versus like the real life decisions people make and how people get caught up in being pawns for other people's agendas and how they react to that. And again, gorgeous, bananas, deeply immersive, well worth your time. There's currently four trades. It's an ongoing series.
That was on my long list too.
Bananas.
Like, so good.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, John, what about you?
Okay, so from a very long book, I'm going to a very short book that was published back in 1999 called The King of Persia, written by Walt Holcomb, who was he is still a cartoonist who published comics for a brief time in the late 90s, early 2000s, and then just absolutely disappeared. He has, in fact, gone to a career in animation, and you'll see his name pop up in various places. I think the last time I saw it was he was one of the animators on the HBO Ricky Gervais animated series. But he kind of appeared out of nowhere, and the King of Persia was funded by a Xeric grant, if people are old enough to remember Xeric grants, which were another aspect of Eastman and Laird's attempt to bring something like respectability to the comics world in the 90s. And you can get this book either in a single form or in a compilation called Things Just Get Away From You, which was published in 2007 by Fantagraphics that collects like all of his print comics. The King of Persia is hard to describe. It looks like a sort of a big nose 1930s newspaper strip, kind of like E.C. Segar, or maybe a little bit like a Max Fleischer cartoon. Very bouncy, very distorted, silly characters. And it is ostensibly a pastiche of an Arabian Nights story, the story of King Faisal of Persia trying to win the love of his of the woman of his life by stealing an emerald from an underground country, but it is not anything like what that might lead you to believe, because it's all written in this very strange borscht belt dialogue, sort of like a Marx Brothers movie. And it is very sly and weird, and you think it's going to go one way and it ends up going a completely different way. And it's very, very funny until it's absolutely dead serious. And ultimately it is about the relationship between King Faisal and his trusted camel Jamila. and it is so unusual and so unlike anything. If you get the original version of it, it has an introduction by Chris Ware, in which he describes his utter flabbergasted reaction to reading this the first time and how sad he was that he hadn't written this story himself. It didn't get a lot of attention, I think, when it first came out. So I do recommend people find it. You can find it used for pretty cheap.
All right, King of Persia. Got it down. Nathan, your turn.
Okay. So I spent a lot of my childhood in Britain as an Air Force brat. And so weird aspects of British culture have kind of lodged themselves in me, and I carry that fondness for them through my life. And that's why I like Jack Staff by a cartoonist named Paul Grist. Grist decided that he would try to recreate the format of the British comics he read as a kid, where there would be lots of short stories, each involving a bunch of different characters, except that in Grist's comic, they all start bleeding into each other and overlapping with each other in really funny and delightful and surprising ways. Jack Staff is Britain's greatest hero, but 20 years ago, he disappeared and no one knows why. And then all of a sudden, strange things start happening in the little town of Castleton, and Jack Staff has to return. And the joke of the series is that while Jack Staff is a great guy, he's not a very effective superhero. He always seems to get beat up and lose his fights and get saved by Deus Ex Machina, even though he's trying really hard and he's a wonderfully decent chap. But the joy of Jack Staff is watching how Jack, who was originally designed to be Union Jack. This series started out as a pitch for an Invaders and Union Jack series at Marvel that, for reasons that will become obvious when you read the series, would not fly. I don't want to spoil it. There's a twist involving the Captain America character that's pretty great. But so the joy is seeing Jack interact with all the other characters who start popping up in Castletown, including Becky Burdock, vampire reporter, and a bunch of characters who are based on sort of public domain classic British comics characters of a certain era. Alfred Chouinard, the spider, a gentleman, master thief, Tom, the robot man, sort of like the British version of Iron Man, a mysterious secret agent called the Claw, a group of eerie investigators who can't seem to stay dead called the Q, and a bunch of other really weird, wonderful characters whose lives and whose stories start intersecting with each other in really fun and delightful and often funny ways. Grist has a really deceptively simple cartooning style, but when you stop and really look at it, his fundamentals are rock solid. His anatomy, his perspective, everything. He also does a lot of really interesting, fun, formalist experiments. There's a great story where an Alan Moore type character appears, and all of his dialogue is one panel ahead of what all the other characters are going to say to him. So, you know, in the moment, it makes no sense, but when you stop and look back at it, he is one step ahead of all the other characters, and he's insufferably smug about it. it's utterly delightful. The problem is, like so many other wonderful projects that Paul Grist has done, namely the detective saga Kane and a very short-lived, really fascinating teen superhero comic for Image called Mudman, whose twist was that the protagonist may or may not have survived the incident that gave him superpowers. Jack Staff doesn't end so much as it sort of stops. There are four trades available for Image Comics, and then there are some uncollected issues that you can find on Comixology that kind of, again, peter to a halt without any real satisfying resolution. But if you just go with the first trade. Everything used to be black and white, which collects the first 12 black and white issues of the series before it moved to color. They're absolutely delightful. It's a huge, thick, satisfying slab of comics at a fairly cheap price. And it's just a hoot and a half to read.
All right. Got it. Jack Staff. Chip, your turn.
I am following that with a story that is not a hoot and a half, but it is sad, but it is also very good. It's a Comixology original called Liebestrasse, if I'm pronouncing.
You recommended this on the Slack earlier this year, and it was lovely.
Yeah, it is lovely. It is sad. It's less than 100 pages long, so it's a quick read, and the art is very expressive and simple, so it's an easy read except for the subject matter. And it is the story, it's a story of a businessman from America who comes to Berlin during the Weimar Republic, and there is an art dealer that he encounters named Philip, and they fall in love, and it's the Weimar Republic, and it's late in the Weimar Republic. So we, the readers, know exactly what is happening. People in the arts community, the sort of bohemian subcultures, in a certain amount of denial of what's coming and arguing about the state of Germany and then the inevitable happens. It's beautiful and sad. It is not, I wouldn't call it a brutal story. It's not a not a devastating story so much as it is a sad story, and I think it's an important story. My previous recommendations were sort of timely in terms of sort of economics and satire. This one's kind of timely for politics, but it's a beautiful little story, simply but elegantly drawn. Liebe Strasse.
All right, very nice. Thank you, Chip. And that brings it to me. What am I going to do here? I'm going to go with, yes, it is in the theme that I'm going to break from in round three. It's another Marvel comic that is done in a very different form than you would expect. And I'm also going to bring back old Chip Zdarsky to the equation, already chosen in this list. I'm going to bring Chip back. Not you, Chip. Another Chip. Chip Zdarsky.
Any Chip is a good Chip.
And Mark Bagley, who drew Ultimate Spider-Man for 100 plus issues, I think. It's, or 70 issues. Lots of issues of Spider-Man. He knows how to draw Spider-Man. And that's good because this is a miniseries called Spider-Man Life Story. And just as I really enjoyed and actually got me back into reading comics, the classic Kurt Busiek series Marvels, which was a beautiful kind of, and Alex Ross, I think, painted beautiful storytelling of retelling of classic Marvel comic stories from the 60s and 70s. Life Story has a similar premise. In Spider-Man Life Story, the idea is that Peter Parker is the age that he is when Spider-Man first hit the scene as a comic book. But rather than enter the Marvel Comics infinite time scale where nobody ever ages or grows or changes, even as time moves along, Spider-Man Life Story ages Peter Parker with the times. And so as time goes on, you see Peter get older until at the end he is an old man, because Peter Parker would be an old man today. And that's what we see, is an old man today. So you get to see sort of what would happen in the life of a superhero that you know as a fictional character, but placed in the context of aging. And how would the different phases of life affect him and what he does? And I think it's a very clever idea and very well executed. And if you grew up with Spider-Man comics and maybe are not in your 20s anymore, let's say 30s anymore, older, maybe you might appreciate seeing what happens to that familiar character when they are, living life like the rest of us, 1 year at a time. So Spider-Man Life Story. One more round. Let's go around one last time. David, what do you have?
All right. Well, I'm trying to save all my things I've talked about on other episodes for the long list, because, there are other episodes for that. But one thing I have talked about in the past is Gotham Central, which was by Greg Rucka and Ed Brubaker, and they traded off. And this is another series by Ed Brubaker that takes something familiar and twists it. It's a series called Velvet, which kind of imagines what if a James Bond type got killed, and the person who first gets the blame for it is Miss Moneypenny, and she turns out to be the most dangerous secret agent in the world. And it's kind of amazing. There are three graphic novel volumes that collect all of the issues of it. They haven't put any new issues out in a while. And I think they have a hardcover collection of all of them.
Yep.
But they're Before the Living End, The Secret Lives of Dead Men, and The Man Who Stole the World. I mean, they're great titles. They nail that whole James Bond aesthetic, the whole, 60s spy-fi kind of thing. But with more interesting stories and representation. And Velvet Templeton is just a great character. So, yeah, I can't. Pretty much, if Ed Brubaker wrote it, go check it out. Fatale, The Fade Out, Sleeper, Criminal, they're all good. But this is the one that sort of hits my James Bond happy place.
All right. in the James Bond Happy Place.
I'm just going to throw in another plug for an Ed Brubaker thing, since I don't think I'll be able to fit it on my list. Mm-hmm. He's doing a series on panelsyndicate.com. You can buy it for whatever you want to pay, called Friday, with the great Marcos Martin and Munza Vicente on art. And it's basically like, what if Encyclopedia Brown and Sally grew up in the 1970s and then things started getting really dark and kind of occult?
Okay. Lisa, your choice.
You know, I vapor locked for a minute there because it's like, just one? What? What am I doing here? And I think instead of reintroducing you all to my monologue, Gail Simone, just read it all, I am going to go in completely
Seconded.
Yeah, I may have talked about this before. I really loved Scalped by Jason Aaron. It was a Vertigo title. It's collected into a number of trades. It is a blend of noir and Native American reservation politics, and the art is stunning because it's simultaneously spare and brutal and layered all at the same time, if that makes sense. And Jason Aaron has an ear for dialogue that I just really, really enjoy. the first time somebody commits an act of violence on somebody else and concludes with "Hoka hey," string of profanity there, you're like, oh, that fits. And it's funny and dark, and the ending makes sense, which can be very, very difficult when you have to wrap up a monthly. I'm sure I'm not the only person who's ever read a monthly series for years and years, and then when they get to the last three issues, you're like, this is how they're wrapping it up? What? I'm supposed to? No, like, the plotting is solid. The arcs, the story arcs are great. And, you know, the first time I saw a Taylor Sheridan movie, like Hell or High Water, and then when I saw Wind River, I was like, oh, this is like seeing some of the ethos of Scalped that's escaped. It's all about questions of how do you construct a quote-unquote American identity on land that may have been taken from you, or land that doesn't belong to you, and how do you decide who you are in a society where you've been reduced to a series of icons or a political football? And I just really think this is, it's kind of stunning that this series doesn't get talked about more. Jason Aaron has gone on to do a lot of really good mainstream work in comics. He gets handed books at Marvel a lot from what I can recall.
Yeah, he did a very good Doctor Strange run that I enjoyed a lot.
Yeah, I just finished his Doctor Strange run because I got it at the library.
It's the don't ask what's in the refrigerator is all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but Scalped is so original, and it's a perspective and a region and a story that you don't see a whole lot in comics. And if you like Taylor Sheridan's films, or even if you like the cheerful mayhem of Sons of Anarchy, if you're like, oh, that's kind of a guilty pleasure, like, you'll like Scalped.
Now, Lisa, this is the first time that you've chosen Scalped in any sort of draft or anything. Uh-huh. Or whatever this thing is. But I will point out that you have liked this so much that you have mentioned it in passing in episode 122, 230, and 336.
I just really want people to read it.
So what I'm saying is read it, people. Read it.
Then I can stop talking about it.
You may remember that was our, that last one was our, you had me at Splorch, which could have been something that John said when I introduced him, but he didn't say it. John, speaking of whom, it is your turn for one last pick for the reading list.
Well, I have 16 choices. No, I'm recommending all of Rick Geary's mystery novels. No, actually my choice is a fringe comic called Aya of Yop City, which is written by Marguerite Abouet and drawn by her husband, Clément, let me see if I get this right, Ubrery. Sorry if I got that wrong. It is the story of three young women who are friends growing up in the Ivory Coast in the 1970s and their interrelated family dramas. It's a very slice of life story, but enormously charming, enormously descriptive of what life was like in the Ivory Coast in the 1970s, only about 10 years after achieving independence. The Ivory Coast was having something of an economic boom. The culture was changing, and it was particularly changing for young women. And this is a story about changing roles for women at that time. The main character, Aya, is a much more independent young woman who wants a career of her own. She has a friend who has gotten herself pregnant out of wedlock. She's got another friend, and they all go in sort of different directions. Some of the stories will feel very familiar to anyone who's ever read a coming-of-age story, but if you're like me and you know absolutely nothing about the Ivory Coast, it's just an amazing book to spend a long time learning about a culture you know so little about. And it's just it's beautifully drawn. I believe in France it was originally done in something like six of those Bande Dessinée volumes. Drawn in Quarterly has translated the whole thing. It's available as a single standalone comic. I also just now, looking up some information about it, learned that it was made into an animated film in France in 2013. I'd never heard of it before, so I will look that up.
Yeah, check it out. All right, I've never heard of that either. That sounds fascinating. Aya of Yop City, I've added it to the list. Nathan, what do you have next?
Okay, so this hurts because I've got a ton of titles left on my list, and I would love to pull Elisa and find some tenuous justification for naming them all, but I'm just going to go with one, and it's by possibly my favorite person in comics. If you go up to Carla Speed McNeil at a convention, at least in my experience, she will very patiently listen to you while you fanboy out at her about how her stories and her art are incredible. And then she will start casually digressing into something like a lengthy discourse on the Roman memory palace as mnemonic device. Carla Speed McNeil is a flabbergastingly brilliant human being, and her magnum opus is called Finder. It is a science fiction comic. It's a family drama. It's also a satire and about a million other things. And it's really hard to sum up, except that Finder is basically like if Carla Speed McNeil opened the top of her head, like that sequence in Lock and Key, and let you look inside. This woman knows what kind of drawings characters keep in shoeboxes in the backs of their closets. That's how detailed her imagination is. And she's applied it to this bizarre, far, 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 far future world where society is both completely unrecognizable and utterly familiar. And it starts out as a sort of family drama involving a fractured family whose patriarch is a very bad dude and is trying to worm his way back into their lives. And their friend, hanger-on, he's also kind of got a little something-something going on with the mom called Jaeger. Jaeger is as close as the series gets to a central character. He's a man in conflict with himself. He has weird genetic alterations that both allow him to heal from any injury and make him sick if he stays in any one place too long. In his culture, he is both a sin eater, which is like the lowest of the low among his people, and a finder, which is like the noblest of the noble. So he's got that push and pull within him. And also he's basically like Hugh Jackman as Wolverine in the X-Men movies, but somehow even sexier. And this series hopscotches all over the map. There are family drama stories. There's a great story arc called King of the Cats, where Jaeger finds himself in a sinister parody of Disneyland, navigating political disputes between people with lion heads, while also finding himself being made into a theme park attraction in real time, very much against his will. There's a section called Dream Sequence, which I love, which is about a guy whose Imagination is the most popular massively multiplayer online role-playing game in existence because he's hooked up to it 24/7 and his brain provides the story and the environment. And it's about what happens when a monster starts stalking the inside of his brain and seriously damaging the players, and he has to try to hunt it down and find out what is going on and who is haunting his head. And there's about a billion other things. There's a new story coming out called Chase the Lady. You can jump in about anywhere, and I guarantee you will be completely lost and baffled, but you will love it. And the more you read, the more it'll make sense. McNeil's art is gorgeous. You may have seen it on No Mercy from Image Comics or on some Empowered specials that with Adam Warren for Dark Horse. The Finder Library is available from Dark Horse, and that's where you can check it out. And it is just like nothing you've ever read, a mix of Will Eisner, manga, and at least only in its imaginative use of lettering, Dave Sim. And you will not be sorry that you read this comic. It's going to blow the top of your head off. It's really extraordinary.
All right, Finder, which I have never heard of. Ooh. I was making new folders, compressing things, opening new windows. But that's not what you meant at all.
It's no, although I love that too, but no.
Right click on something, you can compress it. It's a whole thing. All right. Thank you.
Carlos Speedos.
Chip, what do you have?
I'd like to throw in a traditional superhero comic, if I might.
Well, you're not going to get any argument from me, because that's what I've been picking. Go ahead.
Ooh, there we go.
How about a young man by the name of Jaime Reyes and a character called the Blue Beetle? Back in 2006, as was DC's and has been DC Comics' want from time to time, they'll kill off a hero to reformat the hero as somebody possibly more marketable. And Jaime Reyes became a superhero in the sort of classic Marvel mode, actually, of a teenager trying to do good with challenges and family struggles and things like that. And I'm pointing specifically to the first 25 issues of that Blue Beetle series that started in 2006, written by Keith Giffen, who is best known as the creator of the Justice League International and had a really long stretch years ago with the Legion of Superheroes, and John Rogers, who was just a year or two out from becoming the showrunner of one of my favorite guilty pleasure shows, Leverage.
Mm.
So, It's a witty series. It's very accessible. If it's not overly burdened by crossovers, and at heart, it's a bunch of kids trying to do good and do the right things, and there are love triangles and all this other stuff. But basically, it is fun and it is funny. And those 25 issues, which are collected in 4 trade paperbacks, are just a good superhero yarn. So Blue Beetle by Keith Giffen and John Rogers.
I love Keith Giffen. He's so funny.
And Leverage is coming back.
Yeah.
With John Rogers. Yeah. For Amazon. With Noah Wiley.
Well, that just made my night.
Gasp. All right. That is good. I read that in its original run too, Chip, and I loved it. Absolutely loved it. It's great. I'm going to finish by going away from the Tights and Flights, and I'm going to hand it over to a selection made by my wife, who is a librarian, and who, when we got married, did not understand these comic books / graphic novels or why one would want to read them. Mm. But as a children's librarian, she has had to read a lot of graphic novels, and she's had to figure it out, and she has, and I'm very proud of her. And she recommended a book called They Called Us Enemy, which is by George Takei, adapted by Justin Isinger and Stephen Scott.
Yes.
This is George Takei's story about going into the concentration camp in America as an American citizen during World War II because he was Japanese. Mm-hmm. And the rest of his story, but that's the center of it, is that that experience in the camps and the internment camps in the U.S. during World War II. A very, very good book, powerful stuff. And if you passed it by because you thought it was some sort of a celebrity, you know, dithering, dallying, having a, you know, good time making a funny book or something like that, do not. It is a brilliant adaptation of his memoir, of his novel. And I think it's a novel or a memoir. I think it's a book that got turned into a comic book, but it is beautiful and worth reading. So They Called Us Enemy. Check it out.
There's also a Broadway. I don't think it made it to Broadway, but there is a musical that they recorded. I believe it's on Broadway HD, which is a lovely app for live theater on tape. And it starred Takei, and it's called Allegiance. Yeah.
Yes.
I read his actual memoir a couple of years ago. My brother got it for me. And what actually struck me about his memoir was how much time he spent talking about his time on the LA City Transportation Commission and his activist engagement. And he just came off as somebody who's very much into participating in the world around him. So I'm absolutely not surprised by this.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
All right, I will go around very quickly. If you've got a few more items, I don't want a list with 50 things in it, David. But if you've got a few more items that you regret you could not have mentioned, mention them in passing, and we'll just do that really quickly before we say goodbye. David, really quickly, short list items.
March by John Lewis, Persepolis, Mouse and Mouse 2, and Francisco Francavilla's Black Beetle, but especially his five issues collected as a single book, adaptation of Will Eisner's The Spirit called The Corpse Makers. If you love Francisco Francavilla illustration, he's also a really good writer too. And so that and The Black Beetle are fantastic. And then my last, I mean, I'll just forget all the things I've talked about on other episodes, but there's one that kind of has a sentimental thing because it's from a Hope Larson, who adapted A Wrinkle in Time, which was my very first Incomparable as a panelist. Yeah. And she has a series called Goldie Vance, which is about a 16-year-old girl who lives at a resort in Miami, and she wants to be the house detective. And it's just charming.
All right, Lisa, any leftovers?
Yes, Air by G. Willow Wilson, which ran for 2 years. It's really trippy. It's her pre-Ms. Marvel work. It's about a flight attendant who may or may not be able to hop dimensions, who also pals around with Amelia Earhart and Quetzalcoatl. So see if you can hunt that down and find that. I also had Local by Brian Wood and Ryan Kelly. It's a 12-issue series, and it feels like an artifact of the last days of the 20th century, early 21st century, when you could still basically drop out of your old life and start a new one just by relocating someplace. And it asks a lot of really interesting questions about place and character. I do not apologize for how much I enjoy God Hates Astronauts by Ryan Brown.
So great.
Oh my God. It's bananas. It's bonkers. And it's the kind of thing you read if you're like, I don't need a book with anything resembling Earth logic. And the one comic book I am trying to find that I deeply regret giving away when I gave away all my long boxes is The Intimates by Joe Casey and Jim Lee. It was through Wildstorm, I think. And basically, it was a book about a bunch of kids at a bunch of superpowered kids at a superpowered high school. What made it so special was the quote-unquote information overload storytelling style, where you'd have hypertext quote-unquote bubbles popping out of panels and a whole running ticker at the bottom. And the first time I read Squirrel Girl after this, I was like, I've seen this before. Anyway, The Intimates was another 12-issue run. It was like back in, I want to say 2005 or back in 2005. Visually stunning, very much an artifact of its time. The writing is kind of vibing off that whole superheroes, but edgy thing with a little mix of tabloid culture. So again, it's very much an artifact of the decade, but beautiful, fun to read, kind of a precursor for some of the more self-aware stuff going on in comics now. And the last one is Atomic Robo by Brian Clevenger and Scott Wagner. I love that one so much. And
that was on my list that I left off my list.
Yep. The crystals are integral to the process is like one of my favorite things to just scream for no reason. So yeah, there you go. That's my list.
So good. John, leftovers?
I might as well go back to the Rick Geary series of Victorian murders and American murders. Since 1987, Rick Geary has been doing these slim volumes about famous murders solved and unsolved from the 19th and early 20th century. They are beautifully drawn in that strange, scratchy, inky style that Rick Geary does so well. He doesn't use dialogue. He tells it almost entirely through a narrative voice, but he also does amazing things with infographics. So the comic will suddenly become one of those bird's eye views of the crime scene. They're amazing books. There are a lot of them. I guess I would suggest the Lizzie Borden one, because I am from Massachusetts and Fall River is just about a 20-minute drive away from me. I would also recommend Sarah Glidden's How to Understand Israel in 60 Days or Less. Sarah Glidden is a self-publishing cartoonist who got this book picked up by Vertigo back in 2016 or something like that, which is about her birthright trip to Israel. She's a progressive leftist Jewish American who thought she had Israel all figured out. She went on this birthright tour and found that everything is much more complicated than she thought it could ever be. And if you are a person who likes personal memoir or who likes political history, it's an amazing look at a very complicated subject. And beautifully drawn. She's got this incredibly simple line drawing style with watercolor colors. And finally, I'll just say I just on a whim, because it was on sale on Comixology, I bought all of the Monsieur Jean series by Philippe Dupuy and Charles Berberon. It was a series I was aware of and was very having been very popular in France. I'd never read them because to me they sort of look like sort of like vignettes of singles dating or something like that. But when I read them through, they were astonishingly beautiful and complex stories that start out as a series of sort of vignettes of Parisian single life in the early 90s and become a very complicated set of interrelated stories about a man, his long-term boyfriend, not his long-term girlfriend, his friend who is a ne'er-do-well, do-nothing, who comes with a son from an ex-girlfriend, and the strange family that they all make together. It's a lovely thing. And I was able to get it, the whole thing, for $5 on sale on Comixology. So go see if you can still get that.
Take that, Eddie Campbell.
Campbell. All right, Nathan.
Cry himself to sleep on his big pile of
movie money. I was just going to say, he's got movie money. He's fine.
Okay, so my Bring Out Your Dead list includes The Complete Terminal City by Dean Motter and Michael Lark. It's a farcical crime caper set in a city of the future gone to seed, and I recommend it for the puns alone. When you've got a hotel called the Herculean Arms, whose bar is called the Elbow Room, you know what you're getting into, and it's great. I'm going to recommend Hawkeye from Marvel Comics, but not the one you're thinking of. This is the Kate Bishop Hawkeye series, written by Kelly Thompson with amazing art by Leonardo Romero. It's fun, it's clever, the art is next level great, and it is a worthy successor to the very popular Matt Fraction and, David Aja series. The Damned by Cullen Bunn and Brian Hurt, which is like if the Coen brothers' Miller's Crossing got mashed up with Dante's Inferno, starring a gangster whose curse is that he just can't stay dead. All-Star Superman by Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely. You will believe a comic book can make you cry. This has it's definitely got the greatest single page in superhero comics. It might have the greatest single page in all of comics ever. And if you've read it, you know the page I'm talking about. Also in the Superman vein, Edison Rex. It's a webcomic by Chris Roberson and Dennis Culver. What if Lex Luthor finally killed Superman, discovered that he was right and he was actually the good guy all along, and then set out to save the world with a group of reformed supervillains by his side? It's fun, it's funny, it's surprisingly complex. And finally, from that panel syndicate site I mentioned earlier, The Private Eye and Barrier, two series by Brian Vaughn, Marcos Martin, and Munza Vicente. The Private Eye is a noir caper set in a future world that is post-digital and has renewed its focus on privacy. Barrier is a wonderful story about aliens of the illegal and space varieties, both, that does a great job of playing with language barriers and refusing to translate dialogue in different languages. It's beautiful. It's thought-provoking. It's really sweet.
All right, Chip.
All right, I am going to politely dissent from Nathan's statement of another there being a contender for single greatest page in comics history. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to the Grant Morrison run of Animal Man, four words, I can see you.
Okay, fair enough.
Grant Morrison's Animal Man, one of the seminal meta-human stories out there. It's been a while since we've had a Marvel movie, and I think that this is sort of the right time to revisit one of the classic reimaginings of the Marvel characters, Neil Gaiman's Marvel 1602. I think this is a good time to revisit that one.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
And I also, I'm not one for post-apocalyptic storytelling for the most part, but this book called Wasteland by this guy named Anthony Johnston really, really appeals to me.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I almost mentioned The Fuse for the same reason.
There's actually another comic that almost made my hit list that seems extremely Anthony-like.
And then the last one I'm going to mention is, you know, there are people out there who actually are not aware of or have heard a lot of people talking about Hamilton and just, you know, need to be told to see Hamilton when it comes out on Disney Plus. In the same way, there are probably some people out there who actually do need to be told that, yes, they do need to read Bone by Jeff Smith.
Yes.
It is so well regarded. It is it hit the mass markets years ago with Scholastic books, and yet it really is that good. The Walt Kelly style of artwork, the early whimsy that sort of escalates into this really, really long run of stories until it gets very very epic, very Lord of the Rings-ish in the end. I think it's one of the pinnacles of the art form.
All right. And I also had a list of things that I realize I have talked about on this podcast before, so I'm going to limit it to two that I haven't mentioned before. One for me and one for my wife. I'm going to recommend, if you're a Star Trek original fan, Star Trek Year 5 is a comic series from it's sort of a writer's room. Telling the story of the last year of the original Starship Enterprise's voyage, some modern storytelling techniques, but also really trying to make it feel like the original Star Trek series. A lot of fun, way more fun than I thought it would be. Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly are the showrunners, but they've got a lot of different writers coming in to write sort of every episode, sort of about a two-issue episode of the original Star Trek, an imagined fifth year. So that's kind of fun. And I'm going to recommend from my wife, Dragon Hoops by Gene Yang. He is a best-selling comic book writer. He is also a high school teacher in San Francisco, and he did a graphic novel that is about his high school and his high school basketball team and sort of learning to love the team on a championship run, and learning to understand, as somebody who's a little nerdy and doesn't really get the sports, learning to understand some of the excitement and appeal of the storyline of this team that is trying to win the state championship. And it is, I am told by sources close to me, it's excellent. So check it out. Dragon Hoops, Gene Yang. And that brings us to the end. We have, I don't even know how many things we named, but it was more than 18 because of Lisa.
No, it's totally 18. It's just 18.
I could have, this is like a challenge for me just to name 18 in the first round next time.
Yeah. Wow. So now all I have time to do is thank everybody for being, to adding to this list. I hope we have given you some comic books to read. I certainly think we have. If none of these appeal to you, think again. Just rethink your choices. Let me thank my guests before we go. David Lohr, thank you.
Again, Crack-a-Thoom.
Lisa Schmeiser, thank you.
Thank you for indulging me with my themes.
John McCoy, thank you.
Can I get six more in?
Splorch. Nathan Alderman, thank you.
See you in the funny papers.
Chip Sutter, thank you.
A Thor is a Thor, of course, of course.
And thanks everybody out there for listening to this episode of The Incomparable and the Comic Book Club. We will see you next week. Goodbye.